you've seen, and you talk about anything. He's got this dream about buying some land. He's gonna give up the booze and the one night stand, and then he'll settle down in some quiet little town and forget about everything. But you know he'll always keep moving. You know he's never gonna stop moving.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Got a feeling that what you're going to hear tonight, ABC wouldn't dare put on the air. They wouldn't dare. Or if they did, that would be the 10th show down the line. Tonight, Greg Bishop publishes and edits The Excluded Middle. It's a journal of UFOs, conspiracy, research, psychedelia, and new science. His reports, interviews, and features have appeared in several national publications. Greg has spoken publicly at various conferences and meetings, including most recently the first annual UFO Crash Retrieval Conference in Las Vegas, and the Ancient Science and Modern Secrets Conference in December of 2004. He has also appeared on many radio and television and internet interview programs. For 2 years, he was host, engineer, and DJ for The Hungry Ghost, a radio show of interviews and music airing on Pirate FM station, KBLT in Los Angeles. Pirate, huh? His current show, Radio... What is this? Missiostro, I guess, can be heard on Sundays from 8 to 10 p.m. at www.killradio.org. That's another, I think that's another pirate operation, matter of fact. We'll ask in a moment. Very interesting. If you've never heard him on Coast to Coast AM, but you will in a moment, Greg Bishop. Stay right there. By the way, about a million responses to my new Doisy caller, and that's the only way you're ever going to get that kind of caller message going out here, is open lines. You just simply take what comes. You don't screen it out, you don't edit it out, because you never really know what you're going to get until you explore a little bit. So some of the more classic things that will ever happen on this kind of radio occur when you have truly open lines. Now, to my guest, Greg Bishop. This should be an interesting evening, Greg. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Art.
How did you get involved? First of all, I guess I had to follow up. And killradio.org, that's another pirate organization, isn't it?
No, it's an internet radio station.
But didn't they have a bit of a broadcast facility at one point?
I believe somebody was broadcasting it for a while, but it's been very spotty. I think they were just taking things off the internet and broadcasting them.
Yes.
Out over the Los Angeles area. KBLT went for, I think, 3 straight years until the FCC finally caught up with us.
Closed in, huh?
Yeah. I know that you had a FM pirate, didn't you, when you were a teenager, I think?
Actually, that was when I was in the United States Air Force. And fortunately, by the time I told that story, the statute of limitations had long since expired. But yes, we did it. It was a long story, and it was a lot of fun. So there you are, Greg. You have you've been with the Pirates, huh?
Yes. Yeah. It was quite interesting. I had a very late night show. I did interviews and music for a little over 2 years, till the FCC finally caught up with us and took the equipment and said, "You can either to the person that was running the station," you said, "You can either give us your equipment or we can take you to court and you might have to pay a fine of something like $10,000 or $15,000." So she gave them the equipment.
Oh, an offer she couldn't refuse.
Yes. And she's written a book about it too, mm-hmm. which is
many people have. It's a remarkable thing. At any rate, you must have. I don't know, to be on Pirate Radio, it must mean that you had something to say that was not, well, exactly mainstream, perhaps.
Yeah, it was. You know, it's basically what you do on your show with the open lines, et cetera, except we could say, do anything we wanted. Mm. I mean, there was absolutely no restriction because obviously we weren't licensed.
A total lack of responsibility.
Yes, yeah, so we never got called on anything, really. it was wonderful. Yeah. That's kind of how Kill Radio is now, because internet radio is pretty much the same thing.
Well, I kind of I follow the pirate community a little bit. So, you know, I've always been interested. So
I was surprised you knew that somebody was pirating our signal and sending it out in L.A. in the last, last year they did it.
As I said, I keep track of this stuff.
Ah.
So there you are. All right. Anyway, Richard, how did you get interested in ufology?
Greg, you mean?
Greg, yes. How do you get interested in ufology?
You know, it's very strange. I don't exactly know how I got interested, but I do remember when I was a kid, my father used to take us to the library every week and say, get as many books as you want, read them all, and bring them, and we'll bring them back next week. And we just did this over and over.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, and I can't really tell why, I cleared out all the UFO and paranormal and cryptozoology shelves in one library. We went to another library, and I cleared all those shelves out over the course of a year or so, and then I went back to the first library and did it again.
And somewhere along the line, something caught your eye.
Yeah, it's funny, though, because I was interested in it up to probably about junior high school, and then it kind of dropped out of my life until after I graduated college, and I had a very tempestuous period. And for some reason, the subject came rushing back to me like it wouldn't be denied. It was very strange, and that was in 1988, and since then, that's what I've been interested in.
All right. I sort of promote the possibility of a surprise guest.
Mm-hmm.
Can you confirm that indeed we are going to have our little surprise guest on shortly?
Yes. I called him, and he said that he would be ready.
Okay. Do you want to give his name?
I think I'll let him give his name.
You're going to let him do it, all right.
Yeah, I believe he said it was all right to give his name, but I'll just let him do it because I want to make absolutely sure that's what he wants to do, because he hasn't talked anywhere to anyone publicly.
Well, let's tease it a little bit. He was an Air Force. He worked for the Air Force Office of Special Investigation, is that
right? Yes, uh-huh. Yes. He was an agent with the AFOSI at Kirtland Air Force Base in the late 70s up through the mid-80s, I believe.
And he is going to claim what? That he dispensed unofficial orders, I would presume,
yes.
Disinformation.
Yes, to a certain individual who I wrote this book about.
And that individual is?
Is Paul Benowitz, or was Paul Benowitz. He died about a week before the first time I came out there to start working on interviews for the book.
All right. What was it about Paul Benowitz that fascinated you?
Well, that's kind of a long story. However, what happened to Paul Benowitz, I will tell you the story of Paul Benowitz.
Please.
Is that he lived next to Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and around 1979, he started noticing strange lights flying around the base, doing things that airplanes normally couldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
This is common around military bases. However, he started filming them, and I think videotaping them, if he had some sort of videotape set up, and he also started picking up signals from the base, radio signals. I don't know what band these were on, where you know what exactly the messages contained or what the transmissions were. There were a few guesses I made in the book, but he began to think that these lights combined with these signals had something to do with aliens being around the base. So he made an effort to contact the Air Force and say, do you know you have these things flying around your base, and they're sending out these signals that are very strange. They seem like bursts of information, and do you know about this? And as soon as he called up the Air Force, they were, you know, they get crank calls all the time. So they, you know, questioned him a little bit and started to realize that he might be seeing something that he shouldn't. So.
And what Air Force, I'm sorry, what Air Force base?
Kirtland Air Force Base.
Kirtland, all right, Kirtland.
Yes, it's right, it borders Albuquerque.
Right.
In fact, when you land at the Albuquerque airport, you fly right over it.
Okay, so the Air Force did what?
The Air Force called him in. They called him into a meeting eventually. Actually, first they had this person we're going to talk to go out to his house and try and figure out what it was he was seeing, what possibly he had seen, and what he might be doing with it. And based on that information, they called him in for a meeting at the Air Force Base with a few of the, you know, of the brass and the intelligence people and other people who were doing work on the base.
Oh, you see, now normally this would seem like a pretty far out story.
Yeah.
I mean, just pretty far out, but we actually have the officer that went out to first interview him. So,
yes.
How fascinating is this? All right. And continue with his story.
Well, he did go to this meeting. It was, I think it was in early 1980, I think it was, the first half of 1980. He came onto the base and started to give this presentation. Now, I was not able to talk to anybody who was at this presentation. However, I did talk to a man in the NSA, National Security Agency, who talked to somebody who was at this meeting. I said, so when Paul Benowitz came in, to give this presentation, what happened? Well, in the first place, actually, they thought he might have something because he wasn't just some Joe Schmo. He was an electrical physicist, and he had his own company, Thunder Scientific, which manufactured humidity and temperature calibration and things like that for military contractors, among others.
Mm-hmm.
So they thought maybe that he had his word would carry a little bit more weight when he started describing these things. So this man that was at the meeting said that Benowitz started giving his presentation and started off very slowly and then started in with his, I think these are aliens and alien ships flying around your base, and I think they're trying to communicate with each other or us, and I'd like to know what you're doing about it or if you know anything about it. And the strange thing was that this man told me was that a lot of people, he said maybe there were maybe 20 people at the meeting to begin with, and by the time Benowitz got finished, there were two or three.
Meaning they walked out?
Yeah, they walked out. I asked him, well, why would they do that? I mean, it seemed, he said, I think they thought it had nothing to do with what they were doing, so they left. But there were two or three people that did think it had something to do with what they were doing. One of those people was the AFOSI commander, who I believe at that time was Thomas Shea, C-S-E-H, mm-hmm. and an unidentified man from the NSA.
Hmm.
So by the time he finished this, these two or three people realized that he might be onto something that he wasn't supposed to be. And as it turned out, it had very little to do with UFOs and very much to do with secret projects going on at the base.
That would have been my initial guess, Greg, that it was something at Kirtland going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, hello, it's an Air Force base, probably doing experimental things. Why wouldn't that be, you know, Occam's razor, the very first conclusion anybody would come to?
Well, because Benowitz was, while he had this business, and he was very good at what he did, and he was a very good electrical physicist. A lot of people have said this. While he was, you know, very intelligent person,
claiming they were aliens.
Yeah, he had this kind of Achilles heel. He was very interested in the UFO phenomenon. And granted, those lights flying around, other people saw them, didn't really say anything about them, or if they did, the Air Force said, oh, don't worry about it, and people just generally shut up.
Right.
But Benowitz was very interested because he was basically a ufologist, or very interested in UFOs anyway. And he became convinced single-mindedly that this was what was going on, and nobody could tell him any different.
All right, so at the very end of this story, though, it was things going on at Kirtland, or what?
Yeah, there were things going on there. There were quite a few different projects. I was able to identify maybe two or three of them
mm-hmm.
that were going on, which were things he was directly looking at, and they didn't want him looking at, because if he could see these things, then anybody could. And this was still in the middle of the Cold War, right at the beginning of the Reagan era, 79, 80 there.
Mm-hmm. What did these things turn out to be? Do you know?
Oh, you want to give them away right here at the beginning? Sure.
Well, yeah, I'm curious, sure.
Okay, let's see. One of the things they were doing there, oh, I'm giving away the book now, but one of the things they were doing there was, there's a very great story about how I found this out, which we'll get into later, partially found this out. But one of the things they were doing there was tracking Soviet spy satellites.
Uh-huh.
Because these things would come over, you know, over the base, over the United States all the time. You've seen, you know, after the Soviet Union fell, people were, the KGB or somebody were selling satellite pictures of various places, including Area 51.
That's right.
Which had been taken by these satellites. They'd come over the United States, generally during the day, I think, because that's when you could see things, and take pictures of the base. The U.S. government, the Air Force, the Defense Intelligence Agency specifically, knew that they were doing this, and they wanted to find out how they could possibly foil this espionage, this spying.
Right.
So in... They had agents in the Soviet Union. A lot of people know this. A lot of Soviet agents were here. A lot of our agents were in the Soviet Union, posing as, you know, posing as citizens, doing various things and getting close to defense projects or somewhere in the vicinity of them, so that they could report back on them. But what they found out was how these satellites worked, and they sent back through various channels, sent back information on these satellites. So the people at Kirtland were basically able to back engineer what was going on, or at least engineer a way to track these things and eventually to even control them.
You mean to control the Russian satellites?
Yes, I was told. It's very hard to find any kind of information on this through Freedom of Information, I think. I only had a year to write the book. I had to rely on the testimony of at least a couple people that worked at Kirtland and the suspicions of others.
All right. I have yet to understand what represents the actual lights and craft and things that made Paul Benowitz think that aliens were involved.
I'll have to go back a little bit. In 1979, at the time he was seeing these lights, he was made aware of a very early abduction episode. Now, the way this happened, have you heard of, I'll get to it. This woman was driving back from Oklahoma, you know, the little panhandle there that sticks and touches New Mexico.
Yes.
She was driving back from that panhandle of Oklahoma to her home in northeastern New Mexico. And during this ride, her and her son saw these giant craft hovering over a field. She said one was, you know, almost football field size, the other one's a little bit smaller, and what they said they saw was a cow being sucked up into the bottom of this craft. This is what they remembered.
I actually have heard that story, yes.
Yeah, this is the Myrna Hansen story.
Yes.
And they also had some missing time. Now, back in 1979, this is before Bud Hopkins' book had come out, this was fairly new kind of thing for people to be investigating. You know, as we know, it might have been going on for quite a long time. However, this woman called the New Mexico State Police the next day to try and report it, find out what had happened, if anybody else had seen it. As it turns out, about 10 or 15 years later, somebody else had seen these craft. And her husband, it was a woman, her husband actually was in the New Mexico State Police. However, she called the New Mexico State Police. They didn't really know what to do with it. However, they did know of some guy that was interested. One of their officers was interested in this kind of phenomena, what was going on, and cattle being mutilated by whoever or whatever does it. And this was Gabe Valdez, who you probably have heard of. He was a police officer near Dulce, New Mexico, where there had been a lot of cattle mutilations and strange lights flying around. So apparently people in the New Mexico State Police knew Gabe Valdez as the weird stuff guy. So they referred this woman, Myrna, to him. And Gabe Valdez had actually met Paul Benowitz at a cattle mutilation conference that the state senator, Harrison Schmidt, had convened about a year before.
Well, I hate to rush to this, but if it wasn't aliens abducting these cows or people, then who was it? And if it was the Air Force, why? Always wanted to know that.
Well, there's a lot of theories about cattle mutilation. I actually, on my show, I interviewed Chris O'Brien. Have you talked to him?
No.
He wrote a book called The Mysterious Valley.
And his view is what?
His view, and a few of the other researchers, well, it's multifaceted. It seems like there's a few things that explain many of them, and others, you know, other theories don't. It's very mercurial, if you know what I mean.
Hold on, Greg. We're at the bottom of the hour. My guest is Greg Bishop, and in a very few moments, the man he was talking about, who I will not yet name, and we'll get down to cases. In the nighttime, I'm Art Bell.
River's on fire, no one can save me but you. Strange world desire, make foolish people. I never dreamed that I'd meet somebody like you.
With Art Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is this night with Greg Bishop and a kind of a surprise guest coming up in a moment. We'll sort of try to put what Greg is trying to say into some sort of logical order in a moment. Stay right there. Are you in? Well, all right, let's see if we can get to the bottom of what Greg is saying. His book is Project Beta. This might help. The story of Paul Benowitz, national security, and the creation of a modern UFO myth by Greg Bishop. All right, so Greg,
yes.
so that we can all understand what's going on here.
Would you like me to summarize it?
If you could.
All right. We have talked about Paul Benowitz and what he was seeing. The Air Force became concerned about what he was seeing because it might compromise some things that they had going on at the base, at Kirtland Air Force Base.
Right.
And he kept telling them that it was aliens, and surprisingly enough, they didn't tell him any different. And eventually, it ended up with him in a mental hospital for about 3 months in about 1988. And a lot of these stories he was told, and a lot of stories he came up with that were bolstered by the Air Force intelligence people and to some extent the NSA, ended up as part of the UFO lore and rumor mill through the 80s and up even to today.
Was he of sound mind? I mean, you said he spent some time in a mental institution, or was that just some kind of persecution in your view, or what?
No, he was single-minded that he thought there was an alien invasion imminent and the government should do something about it.
Yes.
And the government did not try to dissuade him from this because they wanted to know, intelligence specifically, they wanted to know what he knew, how he knew it, who he might be talking to or who was listening to him,
mm-hmm.
and what the, you know, how they could protect against that in the future. Because if you have somebody, just a regular citizen, albeit a fairly intelligent one, doing this, then just about anybody could, including who they were very concerned about, which was the Soviets at the time.
All right. Let's bring our other guest on, and we'll let him give his own name. Hi there.
Hi.
Welcome to the program. What is your name, if you wish to give it?
It's Richard Doty.
Richard Doty. Richard, welcome to the program. You.
Thank you.
You were Air Force. You were in the Air Force Office of Special Investigation, OSI.
Yes, I was special agent with Air Force Office of Special Investigation.
Okay. How did you become involved with this Benowitz case?
I was informed that Paul Benowitz had called the base and reported some strange occurrences that were happening near Manzano Base, which was a base within Kirtland Air Force Base.
Okay.
Housing at that time, it was sensitive to say, but now it can be disclosed. It was housed nuclear weapons, one of the probably the largest nuclear weapon storage areas in the Southwest. And it perked some ears on the base, and eventually the information got to our office. I was the counterintelligence officer for the base.
All right.
The information got to my desk, and I briefed my commander, and we sent a little message up to headquarters, and we were tasked with obtaining all the information we could from Paul.
Paul was seeing things, right? He was seeing lights, or what specifically were Paul's claims?
We went, actually, the first time I met Paul, he came to the base. We actually invited him to the base. He went to the base police office, the security police office for the base, and he spoke with a major, and a captain at the time, who was in charge of the base security,
mm-hmm.
and he gave this captain some information about what he was seeing from his house. And he lived in a Four Hills area, which was just adjacent to the base perimeter of Manzano Base.
Right.
On the in the northeast portion of Albuquerque.
Again, what was he claiming to be seeing?
He was claiming, he claimed he saw lights, flashing lights, objects flying around Manzano. He claimed he saw a light shooting out of the sky, out of the ground, into the sky, and then from the sky down into the base.
Hmm.
And so what he did, took upon himself to do, was take pictures and use some electronic monitoring equipment to monitor these strange occurrences, these lights and other things that he was seeing.
Uh-huh. Okay. So he was sort of like a nosy neighbor by the base.
That's a good way to...
And an informed nosy neighbor at that. A guy who apparently knew what he was doing.
Yes.
So you were informed to you were told then by higher ups to what? Make contact with him and do what?
Yeah, we eventually made an appointment. Myself and another person went out to his house. We visited him and we viewed the equipment that he had in his residence.
You were officer rank, by the way?
I was a special agent, yes.
Special agent, all right. And you went out and saw the equipment he had in the house?
Yes. He had two cameras, movie cameras. He had a number of electronic gathering devices that he had pointed towards Manzano.
Uh-huh.
And he showed us all the pictures he took. Well, he didn't show us all at that time, but he showed us some pictures that he had taken, and plus he showed us a lot of the electronic gadgetry that he had.
Yes.
And I brought another person along because I wasn't the technical person to understand the electronics that he had, but this other person was and could understand what he had. And what we did was we viewed everything, we interviewed him, and then we went back and we made a report and we sent it up to headquarters.
And what was the substance of your report?
The report was that this person had a sufficient knowledge and the right equipment to tap into sensitive communications equipment and sensitive projects that was occurring on Kirtland.
I see. All right. Somewhere in the mix of all this comes disinformation. In other words, you are going to admit tonight, I believe, that you dispensed disinformation. Is that true?
That's absolutely true. That's what our in the arena of intelligence, you have different types of intelligence. You have intelligence gatherers and you have counterintelligence. And one task of a counterintelligence division is to make sure that our secrets are protected.
Got it.
And so
here we've got a man who thought that there were aliens among us, as it were, and right in his backyard and over the Air Force base that you were working for. And so what did you tell him?
Well, we convinced him. We actually did. We had two-tier way of doing this. The first thing we did was we became very interested in everything he had.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted him to think that we were very, very concerned with everything that he had. In fact, at some point later on, NSA became involved in this because they were extremely interested in some of the equipment that he had because he was actually tapping into a particular type of communications that he shouldn't been able to do. And so NSA wanted to know, how did he do that?
Right.
So we became very, very good friends, and it's one thing you do in counterintelligence. You become friends with a person, you start vetting him, you start...
Makes sense, yes.
Yeah, and then eventually you start feeding him information. And what we did was we convinced him that what he was picking up wasn't anything... classified from the base, but in fact it probably was of alien origin.
My goodness. Did you really? And how did you do that? What did you say to him to convince him of that?
Well, we didn't have to say really anything. He had the forethought already that what he was picking up, he had an idea.
Yes.
Initially he thought maybe it was classified. He told us, listen, if I tapped into something, you know, let me know. Well, we weren't going to do that because we don't know who his friends were, and we couldn't really, he wasn't a trusted person. So what we did was we said, well, I think what you tapped into is something unknown. So let's work together on this, Paul. So we did, and what we did was we were using his own, everything that he gathered, and we were just turning it around and making him, convincing him what he was looking at wasn't anything from the base, but it was alien in origin. Exactly.
Yes. So you hardly had to say anything, sort of a wink and a nod perhaps at the right moment, or sort of a confirming smile, or nothing more serious than that?
That's it. Initially. We had to do some other things eventually down the road, but initially...
Like what?
Eventually down the road, he claimed that there was a alien base at Archuleta Peak or Archuleta Mountain up near Dulce, New Mexico, in the northern portion of New Mexico.
Many people have thought that, yes.
Right. And so what we did, he kept going up there. He was a pilot. Paul was a pilot. And he would fly up there, and he would photograph things. And he was convinced that the things that he was photographing was actually an alien base.
Uh-huh.
So what we did was we went ahead and fortified his thought by putting a fence up there around some certain things, bringing in some helicopters from Fort Carson, Colorado Army helicopters, which, by the way, they were using that area as a training base also. I mean, it was a classified, at that time, it's not anymore, but at that time it was a classified training area for special operations missions. And they were up there, they were using that area. So there was already helicopters flying around up there.
Well, what did you do, paint them dark jet black or something?
We had a couple of black helicopters, and we had some things planted onto the ground around Archuleta Peak, and just to convince him that what he was actually looking at, he thought it was an alien base.
So it served your purpose. There was probably no other way to stop him from doing what he was doing, so simply convince him that his suspicions are correct, and you have somebody who's just regarded as a nut, and the whole thing is dismissed. Is that the rough idea?
That's a rough idea. It's easier for us to have done it that way than to get a warrant, search warrant, and a seizure warrant, and seize all his property, seize his equipment, and you know what would that do? That would cause a lot of publicity.
Of course.
And the wrong type of publicity that the base wanted.
Well, Richard, many of us want to know how such operations are done, and I guess what I'd like to know, Richard, is how universal you think this kind of tactic is.
It is. It is quite, at least at that time. I'm out of the business now, and I've been out for a long time. But during the 60s and 70s and into the 80s, it was widespread. It was a primary tactic used by U.S. intelligence for a number of things. We're not just talking about UFOs or aliens. We talk about a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
You can use disinformation to disinform anyone about anything if you play your cards right. Now, one thing about disinformation, and this wasn't the only operation we did against somebody with UFO information. But one of the things is giving them enough information that some information that is credible for them to lead them along the path.
Oh yes, because the very best lies, of course, have nuggets of truth buried at
exactly,
their center.
Exactly. And this is an art that is taught. I mean, I didn't come up with all this myself. I was trained. I mean,
did you go to disinformation school?
Well, it was a counterintelligence and counterespionage school, but that's what they taught you.
Yes. So there was a lots of people believed an underground and still do that there's an underground base at Dulce, right?
Yes.
And I suppose lots of people still think there's something going on in and around Kirtland Air Force Base.
I'm sure they probably still do. There are some myths that float over the base, and they still do. I mean, there's people, especially old-timers that live around there, they still think that there's an underground base, and they still think that there's a UFO hidden inside Manzano.
Mm-hmm, I've heard that, yes. So this whole thing then is one gigantic myth, and it's a myth that you admit as a disinformation specialist that you planted.
Well, it just wasn't me. It was a team. I mean, I couldn't have done this all myself.
Do you feel any guilt for this?
Later on, yes. Absolutely. It was meant to be a short-term operation to disinform him and then kind of walk away from it and let Paul think and do. Disinformation, if you play your cards right,
yes.
If the operation's right, all you have to do is plant the seed and walk away, and that person carries it on. And he informs others, and the others believe him, and you know, it just blossoms.
Well, are you aware that, according to Greg, Paul spent some time in a psychiatric facility?
Yes, and I visited him. I visited Paul a number of times. I became good friends with Paul, and it you know, towards the end of this operation, I tried to convince Paul. Now, this wasn't me as a OSI agent. This was me as a person, because I was concerned about Paul's health.
Yes.
I was trying to convince Paul, and I went through his son to do this, that, hey, everything we told you before, Paul, isn't true. And I explained to him why we were doing it. But he never believed me. He said, no, I can't believe you, Rick, because...
Well, right. Lie to me once and lie to me twice, right. You know, that kind of thing.
Yes.
Right? So I can see why that, he would just think you were in official denial. You know, emergency mode, we've got to deny all this.
Yeah.
Because he had bought into the first thing anyway, and you just bolstered that.
Yes, yes, that's exactly. And we tried, I visited Paul, and right up until... I think probably 8 months before his death, I became friends with him, took him to dinner, he never. I tried to talk to him. I tried to talk him away from that subject, and he was totally convinced. Now, unfortunately, during this time period, Paul became friends with some other people.
Yes.
Within the community, within that UFO community. And they were reinforcing on him that it was all true.
Richard, how many other cases like Paul's were you involved in when you worked for OSI?
Three.
Three other
cases? Four total. With
four
Paul.
Total. These were all cases where you intentionally dispensed disinformation on this kind of subject, or was it different things?
No, pertaining to just UFOs, it was the four operations.
Four operations.
Yeah. Was one of the other ones with Linda Howe?
Yes, the other one was Linda Howe.
Holy mackerel. All right, well, I'm going to want to hear a lot about that, Richard. Are you willing to talk about the disinformation fed
yes.
to Linda?
Sure.
All right. My goodness. All right, gentlemen. Let me ask Richard, when was that? Can you recall?
I believe it was 83, 84 time frame.
83, 84.
Yeah, Linda did a very good piece on cattle mutilation some years before that.
Oh, yeah. Well, listen, let's take a break right here. You two hold on. This will give somebody time to call Linda up and say, Linda, you better turn on the radio. Disinformation. Do we really do that?
Get a shiver in the dark. It's raining in the fog. But meantime,
did you ever doubt it?
Sound of the river, you're stopping your whole everything. A band is blowing Dixie, double fall time. You feel alright when you hear the music. Inside, but you don't see too many faces.